Hello and welcome to another episode of Learn With Us. This is Nikos, your host. Today I'm with a recruiter called Guy Bevington. How's it going today, buddy?
Very good, mate. Very, very good. Yeah, yourself?
Yeah, not bad. I'm in Scotland, a bit of downtime. If you can call being an entrepreneur having downtime, but hey, that's what it's like.
You definitely can't. Trust me.
Always thinking about... There you go.
Yeah, it's a Friday though, at least. You've got the weekend coming up.
Although all the weeks merge into one, man. Only day off I have is Sunday. It's a day of rest.
That's a true entrepreneurial answer right there. Saturday is still a work day.
Basically a gaming day. Gaming and Amazon Prime Day.
Type of work, isn't it?
And at church in the morning, you know, it's good. Got to have church in the morning. Otherwise, it's a complete loss.
Fair play. Yeah, good on you, mate.
So me and Guy go back about 10 or 12 years?
Yeah, I was thinking that today. I reckon it's a good 10 years, isn't it?
You're basically trying to pinch me for my first job. and I wasn't good enough to get the job, but I remember him calling me up. And that's actually the first recruiter I ever met. I was in Knightsbridge working away for Moneycorp. And then you just basically says, come and take me for a coffee. And I was actually quite poor back then, so... I remember you taking me to Starbucks and buying me a coffee, and I thought this was the greatest thing ever. You know, you were all dressed up in a suit, and I thought I felt like a celebrity. You know, like
you are a celebrity. Yeah, no, I remember that. Yeah, I really remember that meeting. Yeah, I even remember the Starbucks. It was the two-tiered one, wasn't it? We had the upstairs bit as well.
Yeah, it's an awesome Starbucks.
You obviously made an impression on me.
Yeah, it's Brompton Road. I don't know if that Starbucks is still there.
Not sure. I've not been there in a while, to be honest. But yeah, no, I do remember it. I remember our very early days, and we've obviously stayed in touch since then, haven't we?
Yeah. How long were you doing recruitment when you met me?
When did I start? So I started in recruitment in 2008. So I was working at S3 at the time. So I think it was possibly S3 that we met. Started in, because it was London, so it would have been Gravitas where I was working at the time. I was the first through the door at Gravitas in 2010 when we started up, and stayed there for a good 9.5 years. And then moved on to set up my own thing earlier this year. That's kind of where I am now.
I didn't actually realize you were a good kind of
10-year stint.
I got a bit lazy with my research this morning. Usually people that I don't know, I research more than people I do know. So I'm just going to check your LinkedIn here and see what your new agency is. So what kind of rank did you get to in Gravitas? That's quite a big agency.
So I was associate director. So basically I was first through the door when we started in London. And saw the company grow from just me and the MD. Sat in an office in London, not a particularly big office, to where we are today, which is kind of 200 plus consultants with offices in London, Leeds, Manchester, Hong Kong, Singapore. Obviously it's grown to an amazing size over the last 10 years, and it's a great company. It does a lot of things very, very well.
Not you go.
I was just saying, I just got to the point where, I wanted, more, I suppose, freedom and flexibility because, I've got a family and a couple of young ones, a couple of kids, and just the idea of, working for myself and starting my own agency and having that freedom and flexibility to kind of do things the way I wanted to do them just, made a lot of sense to me. So that's kind of the journey, really.
Because I'm just checking out your website, truenorthgroup.io, and I'm thinking, really cool because you've got like a big full screen like cursor terminal kind of thing, and then I've scrolled down, it's very clean. Our mission, or we want you to put smiles on the faces of the workplace, simple as that. Good clean English. I hate corporate spiel, so I like clear stuff like this. Our passion is Python. We believe that my reasons why Python is rocketing, it pops up. Really nice website, mate. I don't say that lightly.
Good, glad you like it.
And it's mobile friendly as well.
Yeah. It is a great site, actually. I really, really like it. I'm impressed with it. You can kind of see from the initial kind of feel of the website that, everything I'm aiming to do with True North is to kind of buck the trend of the kind of stereotypical recruiter, you know, because obviously recruitment by and large in London, certainly, if not, you know, within the UK, if not globally, has, you know, quite a poor reputation, I believe, for, you know, quality of service and the way people actually treat people, you know, and the kind of service that they provide for people. So I just want to kind of strip it back to its bare bones and, you know, really do things properly, as cheesy as it sounds. And hopefully, you know, we're quite a good testament to that, really. You know, for me, it is about investing in relationships with people for the long term, you know, and we went for a coffee 10 years ago, you know, and we've stayed in touch, and, you know, you didn't even get the job when we stayed in touch.
Yeah, I remember.
So that says it all.
Yeah, yeah. I get a lot of recruiters try and do their own agency, but I don't think they get very far.
A lot of people look at it through rose-tinted glasses.
Yeah.
And it's nice, obviously, working for yourself and being the MD or the founder of a business, but I know, you know, having been there, done that, got the t-shirt with Gravitas from, you know, being part of that business from day one, that it's not necessarily an easy thing, but I knew that if I'd done it before, I felt confident in myself to do it again, and you know, so I was kind of ready for the challenge, I suppose. But yeah, I think a lot of people do try it, and they try it and then all of a sudden assume, because they're working for themselves, they don't have to work as hard, you know, but actually, if anything, obviously, well, we all know any entrepreneur starting a business that you've got to work probably twice, if not three times as hard as you do when you work for a company. So yeah, I think that's why a lot of people kind of try it and fall by the wayside, but now it's going well, you know, for us, we're doing well. And we're just doing, I think, you know, the basics, well, really, you know, just doing the fundamentals of the job, of what people should expect from a recruitment service. You know, we do that, and thankfully, you know, it's working, and we're getting traction, and, you know, building up some really strong relationships with some great candidates, and thankfully some good clients as well.
Nice. So I'm looking at the website again. You've got a lot of contracts on there.
Yeah, so we do contract and permanent. So the business model that we focus on is we purely specialise in Python, software engineering, and data science. So just that particular field, yeah. So as you know from my background prior to starting True North, I was focused on software engineering again, but it was mainly around the Microsoft stack, so C#. So when I got the opportunity to kind of start my own thing, I kind of had carte blanche really on the market, you know, the tech market, and you know, sort of picked something that I thought A was, you know, kind of a technology for the future, but B just something I really enjoyed, you know, kind of recruiting for, and the Python market, I genuinely find it really, really interesting.
Yeah,
you know, I think it's obviously absolutely rocketing in popularity for many reasons, but it's just a really rapidly evolving marketplace, and yeah, it's a nice market to recruit in.
I have a Discord server of about 1,500 users that's on for TensorFlow. So you're welcome to come in there, and I'll give you a special role called recruiter, and you can post like anonymous job specs in there, and then, you know, you're welcome to go down that avenue. We've got one or two recruiters now already.
Cool.
Basically, I was trying to learn data science, and I was finding it very boring reading the docs. So I basically created this Discord server, and then do little mini AI projects with people in there, and it's just keep growing and growing, and I can't keep track of it anymore. There's just so many people on there. Yesterday we had like 10 people join. The day before that we had like 7 people join or whatever, you know. And I've got a habit of creating these Discord servers and just don't have time to manage them all, you know. I've got one for Porsche, got one for Visual Studio Code, one for Mentor CV, or one for just different things, you know.
Fair enough, yeah. Created a beast.
yeah. So in previous podcasts that I've talked about with Reese a few podcasts ago, was like, we're talking about things like Brexit and now IR35 reform. So I've found that the market right now is going crazy with this IR35 stuff. Like, I'm getting companies contacting me and just like, oh, we want you to go on this umbrella company, and like, it's just weird, man. The market doesn't know what to think right now.
Yeah. I mean, I look at it quite, you know, pragmatically, really, quite optimistically, that, you know, the reason contractors exist in the form that they do exist, you know, it's a supply and demand economy. There is a need for this skill set. There's a scarcity of the skill set. There's a need for that skill set. And as such, you know, these software engineers or tech professionals will choose to go down the contracting route because they can obviously get the rates that they get for the skills that they have. And I think that, to be honest, what's going to happen in the private sector is very similar to what happened in the public sector, that, you know, that the public sector could not do without all its contractors, because, you know, fundamentally it'd fall over. So, you know, all that happened within the public sector was there was just another, you know, intermediary body that kind of entered into the situation, where a lot of these contractors were then subcontracted to a master vendor, and then obviously they contracted through them. So ironically, it just entered another layer of cost into the whole situation for the public sector. So, you know, a bit short-sighted view, really, in my perspective, from the government. But I think the same thing is going to happen again within the private space. You know, there's no way that all of these contractors, highly skilled specialist contractors, are just going to go all of a sudden, oh, okay, well, I'm going to go permanent then. You know, they won't do it. Maybe a few will, but certainly the ones that are worth their salt, you know, won't. And, you know, I think there's just going to be an evolution of the contracting model, you know, probably that will present, like you say, another kind of intermediary body that sits between the candidate and the client, or the contractor and the client. I mean, no doubt there's going to have to be a tightening up on contracts to make sure that, you know, the responsibility of both parties is where it should be, and, you know, it's not too onerous for one or the other. So I'm sure there is, you know, changes that are going to be made there. But the fundamental business model of the tech community and the country as a whole, to be honest, I don't think is going to change, because it's not like you're just going to get a load of permies go a load of contractors go perm. I think, you know, people are kind of making a bit of a mountain out of a molehill. That obviously it is a big change, it is a big statement of intent from the government to kind of put it into play, because it's something they've been sort of, you know, chuntering about for years. So obviously, you know, it is coming into effect, but I'm not overly concerned, put it that way. You know, I wouldn't have started an agency a few months back if I was concerned that, you know, contracting was going to dry up totally and the whole market was going to get topsy-turvy. I think it'll, you know, there'll probably be, obviously you heard a lot of these big investment banks, you know, kind of making statements of intent to say that they're going to, right, just get rid of all their contractors come April. But I just think, yeah, right, fine enough, they're going to probably get rid of them, but then they're just going to rehire them again the following month. So, you know, I'm probably not, you know, I'm not as concerned, put it that way, as probably a lot of other people.
Yeah, so another big issue is Brexit. How are you seeing Brexit affect the market right now?
Oh, do you know what, mate? That word is just, I'm bored of it. I'm absolutely bored of it. I heard it so many times. No one knows. Like, at the end of the day, no one's got Scooby-Doo what's going to happen with it, you know, wherever the chips will fall. But again, similarly to what I've just said about the contracting market, I think London is still going to be a powerhouse for business in general, you know, obviously because of our unique position between Asia and the US. You know, we've always been that kind of intermediary trading hub between Europe and the US, and that's obviously not going to change. I think we are going to be able to kind of stand on our own 2 feet better than possibly a lot of people think. And I think from a tech perspective within London, I don't think that's going to change either. I think people will still, you know, tech will still be an extremely strong market within London. So I think the demand will still be there. There's not really been any kind of companies that I've worked with or know of that have made any clear kind of statements to say that we're going to be moving all of our technology out of London now, we're going to move it to XYZ country. And I haven't come across any company that has said that so far. So again, I just think, you know, the world isn't going to stop spinning on its axis when Brexit happens. I think London is still uniquely positioned to be, you know, an incredible powerhouse of business and certainly technology as well. So, okay, yes, it may make things obviously slightly more difficult for people to come over from, you know, other countries, Eastern European countries, which is obviously regrettable, because there are some very, very good software engineers, you know, certainly that do come and choose to work over in the UK. So if that you know, has an impact, then obviously that will be really a shame. But other than that, I still think there's a lot of very good software engineers in UK. There's a lot of demand for those software engineers, and again, I just don't think it's going to have a huge amount of impact. But like I said, who actually knows? Because no one, you know, I don't even think even the rest of the people right at the top of the tree in the government, they don't really know either. So how we're supposed to know and sort of predict the future, you know, is anyone's guess. But yeah, again, I'm not overly concerned, put it that way.
Mm-hmm. Do you see like a large volume of, you know, CV flow when there's like dates announced, like Brexit's been extended or whatever?
Not really, no. Because I think people have just become really immune to the whole Brexit thing. You know, it's like no one, you know, you can't put your life on hold. It's not like, you know, every time there's a Brexit announcement, you know. I just think that people are carrying on as normal. What will be, and you know, I the conversations I have with most people about it, you know, they're pretty relaxed about the whole thing. I think the biggest kind of impact it could really have is just that companies decide not to invest in talent in the UK because of Brexit, and obviously then, you know, there's less funding and there's less demand for the kind of skill sets, etc., that we recruit for. But again, I haven't heard any companies saying that, and certainly no companies deciding to do that. So no, you know, it really has kind of largely gone under the radar for a lot of the candidates that I work with, in terms of, you know, there's the only people that has kind of had an impact on, like I'd say, is people that obviously are, you know, maybe European and have lived in the country for a while. And yeah, I have, it was quite sad actually, had some conversations with certain people that, you know, from Spain or Italy or whatever, and they've lived in the UK for a number of years, you know, and really enjoy being here, but they've actually decided to, you know, move abroad and maybe move back to their respective countries for their next role, because they feel they're not welcome here, which, you know, again, I
I
think
would
it's a,
feel not welcome actually, to be honest.
yeah, which is a real shame, because obviously, you know, it's and I mean, again, who knows really what the kind of, you can't speak for, can't cast aspersions on the whole of the UK's reasons for why they've voted, because I'm sure they're all few and far between. But yeah, personally speaking, I find it really difficult to believe that, you know, xenophobia is one of the driving reasons why people have voted for Brexit to happen. I think it's probably more the bureaucracy and the lack of control, to be honest with you. So I think it's a shame that a lot of people do feel, you know, segregated or kind of, you know, unwanted because of Brexit, and that will be a real shame that we lose, you know, people that have been in this country for a long time and add a lot of value to the country, and then they do decide to go back to their, you know, their other countries, or indeed other countries, because they feel unwanted, you know, and that's definitely a real shame.
I mean, if my situation was reversed and I was brought up in Greece and then came here to work as a professional, I would be quite offended. But I mean, I'm half Greek, half Scottish, so it doesn't really affect me too much. I was basically brought up in a council estate in Glasgow, so if anyone dared say anything to me, then they'd get a bit of my Glasgow friendliness, you know. It's like, oh, you back to Greece or something like that, you know. But when my Scottish accent
Yeah,
comes out, nobody says anything. I've never had anything like that. Go back to Greece. At least in my professional
no.
life, you know.
Yeah, that's it. I mean, I like I say, I can't really speak for people as to why they've, you know, decided to vote for what they have voted for, but I personally don't believe that it's mainly due to the fact that, you know, people from other countries are unwanted in the UK. You know, I think it's more a higher level kind of political control that we wanted to regain back for the country. But you know, look, we can all speculate till the cows come home about what it is, that it is the result that it is, and it'll have to wash through, unfortunately. But yeah, you know, certainly from a market impact perspective, you know, because it has been going on for so long, people have just, I think, become quite immune to it and realize that, you know, we have to just carry on doing what we're doing. The world isn't going to stop spinning on its axis, and you know, when Brexit comes, however the chips fall, you know, there are still going to be a need for businesses in the UK. There are still going to be a need for software engineers in the UK, and people are just kind of proceeding on that basis, I think.
Yeah, I mean, Britain does have some of the best engineering companies in the world here. We could look at our space industry. We're opening a new spaceport. We have BAE Systems, nuclear submarines. We have like Rolls-Royce, Bentley. The stuff that can't be made anywhere else really is made in the
Yeah,
UK.
Dyson as well. Obviously, they're massively up in the game in lots of different areas of engineering as well, with the whole autonomous vehicle project and all that kind of stuff as well. So,
Yeah.
yeah,
We need to get Musk to build a gigafactory here or something.
yeah, that'd be nice, wouldn't it? That's interesting actually, because that's one of the focuses that yeah, when I kind of had went through the sort of concept stage of starting at True North, of, you know, what market would I go into. I knew I wanted to stay in technology, because I just genuinely find, you know, tech interesting, and I like recruiting for it. But one of the areas that I was very close to kind of starting up and solely focusing on was the clean tech space, you know, and renewables in terms of electric vehicles, you know, battery storage and that kind of thing, because the sheer level of investment, obviously, that's taking place in that industry, and the sheer level of kind of evolution and change that's happening there is so interesting. But I still think, you know, obviously when you're starting up any business, you've got to make sure you play into your strengths. And software engineering is obviously my strength. It's what I've done for 10 years. So my sort of model will be, I think, to focus on Python, focus on data science, and, you know, with a view to probably at some point in the future having a niche to move into that clean tech space, you know, recruiting for software engineers within clean tech. Because I also think it's quite, you know, a commendable industry for people to work in as well, because, you know, it's a genuine problem that we need to sort out, and anything you can do to kind of contribute to that on a daily basis is, you know, makes you sleep a bit better at night. Yeah, if we can get onto Elon, I'll send him an email. I'll see if we can get him to sort something out. Ideally, place to Orpington in Kent, so I don't have to travel too far for meetings.
Kent is a fantastic place to live, man. I remember walking in the fields there and eating the plums off the trees, you know.
Oh yeah,
yeah.
That was you, was it?
Yeah. Unbelievable weather there, really.
It's nice, as well. Yeah. It is nice. I mean, I'm from Leicester originally. I don't know if you can tell from the accent, but it's weird because I've been down in London now for so long. Everyone from Leicestershire thinks I sound like I'm from London, and everyone from London's like, you're from the Midlands. So I'm obviously from somewhere in the middle.
I come back to Scotland, people say you got an English twang in your voice, but then after I talk to a couple of them for a little bit longer, I just go back to pure Scottish mode. I'm actually probably sound more Scottish on this podcast than normal because I've been up here for a few days.
I was going to say, yeah, I find that hard to believe. I'm not hearing any English twangs at the moment.
I do work on my Sean Connery accent sometimes.
That's very good.
Yeah.
Nice. I'm rubbish at accents before you ask me to do any.
Yeah. Sure. Say you've got somebody that's at university and they want to, they're thinking about getting a job. Can you explain to them who the recruitment market works and what candidates from universities can expect?
Absolutely, James. So how does the recruitment market work? Well, essentially there's a load of jobs and there's a load of candidates, and we have to put the two together. In terms of how I would approach the market if I were a graduate coming out of university, and again, actually, one of the thought processes behind choosing Python as an area to go into is it is now, you know, really the kind of primary language that is being taught at university. So hopefully people that are kind of coming out of university will have had some hands-on exposure to Python, because, I was reading an article the other day that it's predicted that Python within the next 4 years is actually going to overtake Java, and C is the kind of most more widely used programming language. So I think a lot of graduates, you know, that are going into software engineering now, hopefully are coming out with some pretty good hands-on knowledge of the Python market. And I'd just say to people, well, I suppose my advice would be more overarching than sort of software engineering specific. You know, just go into an industry or go into a job that you genuinely love and you genuinely enjoy doing that thing on a daily basis. Don't go into any industry for money. Don't go into software engineering because you think you can go make £700 a day as a React contractor, which, all right, yes, you can. But if you get out of bed every day and you hate doing what you're doing, your life is just, you know, not going to be worth living. And and that is actually one of the reasons I do really enjoy recruiting for software engineering. And actually what I've noticed with Python in particular is the people that do this market, generally speaking, the engineers within it, absolutely love what they do. You know, they get out of bed every day with a smile on their face. They're truly passionate about what they do, and they don't see it as a job. They see it as a, you know, kind of a hobby, really, almost in a way of life. And you kind of, if you told them that there was no opportunity for them to make any money doing it, you know, and they could only do it as a hobby, I still think they'd be, you know, getting involved with projects at the weekends and doing it, you know, not from a monetary standpoint. So the fact it is such a high in demand skill set and you can make money out of it as well, and very good money as well, is just an extra boosty bonus, really. My advice for anybody getting out of university now is just get out there, do pick the thing you genuinely enjoy doing and turn that into a career, because, you know, the better you are at something, the more value you're going to have to the market, and ultimately by default, the more money you're going to make eventually. And just get out into the community. You know, one of the great things about Python is the community is such a vast open source community. There's so many meetups, especially within London, so many meetups that happen on a daily basis, you know, really. You're never short of actual live physical meetups to go and happen, and just get yourself to those. Get out there, go and meet people in the industry, go and meet, you know, go and meet good recruiters as well, that, you know, you can get your face in front of and tell them a bit about your story and make yourself stand out, so they would, you know, put you forward above potentially any other candidate they've just got the CV of, and, you know, and just start, you know, making tracks and just start doing it, because, you know, there's no point sitting there procrastinating. Just get out there and get involved. That'd be my best advice, I'd say.
Okay, sounds good. I mean, the Python guys really love their stuff in my Discord server for TensorFlow, hobbyists. I don't actually know why Python got so popular. It isn't really a fast language. I mean, JavaScript's faster than it.
Yeah, it's not a fast language. Obviously, yeah, its runtime is not ideal compared to other languages, but I think it's just, it's a really versatile language, you know, and obviously it's I think an easier language for beginners to get involved with. You know, it's a really elegant and efficient language, you know, in terms of the amount of lines of code you have to create, that you have to do to actually create a, you know, if you're trying to create a Hello World app in Java, I mean, I don't know how many lines of code you're talking, but in Python you can do it in, you know, one line of code. And I think if it kind of lowers the barriers to entry for a lot of people to get involved in programming, so I think that's why a lot of people do pick it up, but also because it's just such a hugely versatile language. You know, you can build web applications and, you know, web development with, you know, frameworks like Django, etc. You can do really heavy algorithmic backends, enterprise level applications and kind of data driven applications. You know, it's got a huge involvement in the world of, you know, DevOps with scripting. It's just purely as a scripting tool. You know, it's heavily implicated in data science, machine learning, NLP, computer vision. You know, it's so widely adopted across all of these different areas that I think that's why it's becoming so popular, because it's just got so many different uses and so many different fields, you know. So yeah, and I think that's only a trend that's going to continue, to be honest with you.
Yeah. Cool. So what's the kind of work that goes into setting up an agency? Because obviously it's an all-in thing, because I tried to do a little bit of recruitment side of stuff, but I was like a partial, it's like a page on my website, but nobody took me up on it.
Yeah. that's the point, really. It's a bit like, you know, having an agency or having a website, it's a bit like having a shop in the middle of the Sahara Desert. You know, it could be the best shop in the world, but if no one knows it's there, they're never coming to your shop. So, yeah, you know, within recruitment, it's exactly the same. Like, you could be a great agency, you could work really a really, you know, conscientious and ethical and kind of thorough way, but if you, no one knows about you, or you don't have any relationships, then you know, it's no one's going to give you any business. So what's involved in starting an agency is, you know, for me, it's been a real kind of a really enjoyable exercise, actually, but going back to the basics of just doing parts of the job that I really enjoy doing again. You know, as a director of my previous business, I was pretty much just man managing other people, or doing the client relations side, which, again, I really enjoy the client relations side, but, you know, the man management part of the job, it can become a bit of a thankless task, to be honest, because, you know, again, not casting aspersions on the millennial population of, you know, the society, but a lot of people are out there that kind of want the moon on a stick for not doing any work, and they're just not prepared to kind of work hard. I've never really been somebody that's needed to be motivated externally by anybody else. You know, if I want to do something, I'm prepared to dig my teeth into it. So I found the man management part of the job quite a thankless task, to be honest with you. So I was quite keen to get back to the basics of doing the job, you know, that I enjoyed doing, which is just meeting people, you know, building relationships out with people, and really that is what is fundamentally involved, you know, in the early stages of any agency. Yes, you need to have your company incorporated, yes, you need to have a nice looking website, and yes, you need to have all that, but if you don't actually do the fundamentals of the job properly, then, you know, you will end up like a lot of other people that have tried it before on the scrap heap. And, you know, and I really don't think it's an overly complex model in terms of what you actually need to do to be successful in this industry. So my dad was in financial advice. He was an IFA, and he gave me a book once when I was just leaving university called How I Raised Myself from Failure to Success by a guy called Frank Betcher, who was like, it was written in 1916 or something. It was a proper old book by this American guy. He used to be a baseball player, and then he got injured, or he retired from baseball and went into selling life insurance. And this book was basically about how, you know, he was struggling, really just not getting anywhere with, you know, kind of his business. And all of a sudden, one day, he was in a sort of a sales meeting, and he was just about ready to quit. And the sales manager said, you know, the secret to success in this industry is go out and meet the people. Mm-hmm. And he kind of said that kind of just made him sort of sit up in his chair and go, okay, well, that's something I can definitely do. And, you know, when I read that book, you know, that kind of really resonated with me. I've always been somebody, you know, I like to think myself a people person. I get on with people and I enjoy spending time with people. But in this industry, if you try and do recruitment without physically putting your face in front of people or meeting people, you're going to fail, in my opinion. Because, you know, not only is it your job as a recruiter to actually meet people, to kind of verify and, you know, and ascertain whether that person's actually the right fit for the job, and yeah, whether that client is the company that you'd want to work for, etc. But it's just so vital in terms of actually relationship building. To give somebody your time and, you know, attention is absolutely key. And there's so many recruiters. I mean, you just mentioned it a while ago that, you know, I was the first recruiter you ever met. So many recruiters. I mean, even when I left my last job and I was starting to speak to other recruitment companies, you know, for my own personal career search, you know, when I was thinking about maybe taking another job before starting my own thing, I was absolutely shocked at how few people actually wanted to meet me. I think it was like one person. And to me, it's just that's just recruitment 101. You know, you get out there and you meet the people within your community. Because it's just, I think it's a nicer way to work, but it's just an easier way to work as well. Once you have met with somebody, you know, you've built that relationship up, and, you know, you say, hopefully we're quite a good example of that. We met 10 years ago. We're still in touch. You know, we're doing an interview, you know, podcast today. So who knows what can potentially come of it. But you've got to invest, you know, you've got to invest in your relationships. You can't be a selfish recruiter that just wants to spam people with CVs, because you'll get found out very quickly. So yeah, that's what I'd say it takes to get something up and off the ground. It's just do the basics, but do them proper.
Have you done a podcast before?
I haven't, no. Not yet.
You're very natural.
Oh, thanks, mate. Yeah, you're my maiden voyage.
Yeah, you should consider starting a podcast for data science and Python. Recruitment.
Yeah, I thought about that, actually. I'm actually really keen to do that. Because, again, I think one of the things that will really separate people in the market is just putting quality content out there. You know, lead with value, give people value first and then sell second. And so doing some kind of, you know, I thought about interview formats like this with, you know, the software engineers that I've got good relationships with, that, you know, you can just put some good quality content out there and yeah, give some other people some value. Yeah, it's a really good shout. So yeah, you might be doing one for me the other way around, too.
The podcast market's still growing. I mean,
yeah,
Apple's new Catalina operating system now have a dedicated podcast app, so it was not like stuck with iTunes, and it's really powerful. There's so many good platforms for doing podcasts. It's got to be sort of, if you listen to my episode on here, Learn With Us, a couple of episodes ago, talk about podcasting. But it's, I don't think hardly any recruitment agencies have their own podcast, or they have one that's actually it's got to be, if you're doing a podcast, it's got to be very authentic and very non-spiel, corporate sounding, you know. I can't stand corporate spiel English, you know.
Yeah.
Words like unique or democratization, or even a lot of times people misuse the word AI.
Yeah, well, I can't even spell democratization, so I shouldn't worry. I'm not going to be using that one.
Yeah, unique. You know, something unique is very hard to do something that's actually really unique, you know, or best, or all this kind of stuff. How you prove something's the best? You know, I'm the best developer, the top 1% developer, or whatever.
Yeah, that's the thing, though. I don't think you need to be unique, really. You know what I mean? It's like in recruitment, I don't think anyone's going to come along and just reinvent the wheel all of a sudden, and recruitment's just done in a different way. It's like, you don't need to be unique. You need to be thorough. You just need to do the job properly. Do you know what I mean? If you do the job properly, actually, without, you know, trying to reinvent the wheel. I mean, there's a difference between innovation. Obviously, there's always ways to do things slightly easier and you can innovate, but you don't need to kind of reinvent the wheel. You just need to come along and actually do things thoroughly and properly and kind of be, accountable for your actions with people, and you know, you'll be successful, in my opinion.
Yeah. So moving on, I'm surprised that there's enough money in the ecosystem to support all these different recruitment companies. I mean, sometimes it's the same role, I'll get four or five recruiters come to me.
Yeah. I mean, it's, yeah, I know what you mean. I mean, it's a hugely saturated marketplace. I mean, I don't know what the number is now of how many agencies there are in the UK, but on the last count, when I heard, it was about 35,000, which is pretty bonkers. But
one agency per developer, I think.
Yeah, well, you know what? But actually, 90% of those are between 1 to 10 people. So it's actually quite difficult to scale a recruitment business over kind of 10 people, because you know, what makes someone good at recruitment doesn't necessarily make someone else good at recruitment. So it's that whole knowledge transfer piece, and it's that whole, you could be a very good recruiter, but just because you've got somebody else working in the same business as you doesn't make them a great recruiter just because they're working under the same umbrella of the same company. You know, it's a very personal, you know, unique industry, and people buy into the person, you know, they don't buy into the company, in my experience. So yeah, it is quite difficult, but I don't think, you know, companies that do grow and scale to a certain size, I don't necessarily think it makes them a better company, because it just, there's more margin for error, because there's more people that are potentially not as good as the other people. And, you know, in recruitment, Pareto's law stands very true, that, you know, 80% of the results will come from 20% of the people. And that's very true within recruitment, certainly from what I've seen, you know. So I'm not necessarily looking to create a, you know, a huge, huge agency. I just want to be very good at what we do, you know, just you know, as cheesy as it sounds, be talk about being the best, but just genuinely really dominate this one particular area. Because I think, you know, you should do one thing and do it really, really well. So I've got no real huge aspirations or desires to, you know, take over the world and focus in loads of different areas, because I really enjoy this field. I enjoy this area. I was just saying, to the conversations I have with clients, you know, about some of the conversations they have with recruiters, you know, there are a lot of agencies out there, but there's not many good ones. You know, the people that you know, there's a lot of cowboys in the market, I think, that try and just get away with doing the bare minimum, and I think, you know, they will get the results as such. Whereas I think if people are genuinely conscientious and give a thorough service, and they, you know, care about the people they're working with, as cheesy as it sounds, but just genuine, I'm going to say care about, I mean like actually being accountable to, and, you know, like I say, go and meet someone if they haven't got the job. Yeah, don't go meet someone just because they've got the job. Go and meet them if they haven't got the job, and give them some advice, give them some feedback, give them the genuine feedback, because they'll, you know, they'll respect that, and they'll, you know, they'll hopefully want to work with you again in future. So I'm not bothered about the competition element, you know, long may it continue in my eyes, because, you know, comparatively it just makes you stand out more against the rest of the competition when you're half decent and competent at what you do.
Yeah. My biggest pet peeve with the industry is that a lot of companies, they're very lazy when it comes to recruitment. They just, especially when it comes to senior developers, I despise technical tests with an absolute passion. If anyone goes to my GitHub, they can see how much stuff I've done in open source, but they still expect me to sit and do this basically dumb React, create a React app, you know, thing. It drives me crazy. And I find it very hard to sit and do any kind of programming when someone's watching me like that. I just don't do it. Yeah. It's like trying to, I don't know, do something, but you just can't have somebody else watching, you know. I just find it completely unnatural process. And most companies still do it.
Yeah, it's true. It's difficult, because it's a bit of a catch-22. I mean, a large portion of my service, when I sit down and speak to a client, is, you know, consulting with them on their interview process, because the best engineers don't often go to the best companies, but they go to the companies that have the best interview process, if that makes sense, or the ones that are, you know, the slickest and the smoothest, and make that candidate feel genuinely, you know, like that company wants them. And in this market, certainly within the Python market, you know, the commodity is the candidate. You know, so when you're interviewing a candidate, they're interviewing you as much as you're interviewing that candidate for that job.
Yeah.
So it's about, yeah, but you can kind of see, obviously, the client's perspective on why they do technical tests, because obviously they want to have a standardization of how they interview people. So to have their own tech test kind of gives them that standard, and obviously they want to make sure they're being thorough. But I agree with you. I mean, I sit down often with clients and say, this technical test that you've got, expecting somebody to do. I mean, I have some clients that, or, you know, I've consulted with some clients to change the situation where they've got a technical test where they expect people to sit down for 5 hours.
Oh, yeah, all the time.
Create an application. And it's just like, what? You know, yes, all right, they want a job, but they don't necessarily want your job yet because they don't even know you guys. So why are they just going to sit down? Why are the best developers in the market, where other companies are inviting them straight in for an interview to get to know them, to kind of, you know, basically get that relationship started sooner? Why are they going to then sit down and do a tech test for you for 5 hours before you've even given them the time of day to invite them in and, you know, get them emotionally invested in you? It's just a really short-sighted way of trying to do the process. And it's not to say that, you know, all companies should eliminate tech tests, because I understand the reason why they have them in there. Obviously, they want to make sure people can walk the walk as well as talk the talk. But there's a time and a place to, you know, bring that into the process. And like you say, the conditions sometimes of which those technical tests are administered, I feel genuinely sorry for the people when they've got to go into it, like you said, to sit down and code with someone standing over their shoulder. You know, I things that I've done, you know, for 30 plus years on a pretty automated basis, if someone was sitting there watching you do it, it's enough to make anyone kind of fall to pieces, isn't it? So
yeah,
it doesn't really give them the
it's
best.
Horrible. It's like, I don't know, man. It's just like, I don't know. It's just weird, man. Especially with the contract market. You know, if you imagine trying to get a plumber to come in and you give him a job and say, okay, just prove to me that you can weld this pipe to this pipe, you know, whatever like that. And
I don't get it
at all. Contract market. I mean, any senior developer can talk to another senior developer and find out pretty quick if they actually know what they're talking about, you know.
Yeah.
And say, okay, show me on GitHub how you did this. You know, you can see their time flow. Yesterday I cranked out like 4 or 5 commits doing an authentication wrapper around something. I mean, it's kind of complicated, but I mean, I was in my flow, right? So people could look at that and say, okay, how are you doing that? Not sit and write down, oh, how you display this list of items in React or some like obtuse example with multiple closures and you've never seen it before and expect you to just like,
yeah,
do it perfectly. It's just endemic in this industry, and I just think it's just it's not sustainable, really. It just makes people that are developers just want to stop developing and just start their own companies. And I mean, that's what I'm doing anyway. I mean, I'm doing a few things, but I just find the whole thing is just pretty depressing, actually.
I know what you mean. I mean, I sometimes with candidates that I'm representing that I just know in my heart of hearts are quality engineers. You know, I've placed them 4 or 5 times before. They've always done a really good job for me. You know, I will go to a client and say, you don't need to tech test this candidate, you know, but you can only put your kind of reputation on the line so many times if that candidate doesn't turn out to be good, because obviously you've got to make sure they are a good candidate. But turn around to a client, you know, and sort of say, look, this person, they are genuinely one of the better developers out there in the market. And if you want them to do a tech test, you're probably going to lose them compared to this other company they're interviewing at this afternoon, where they're going to get an offer there and then. And, you know, thankfully, I've had quite a few clients turn around and actually adopt their process and change it and kind of listen to me, because obviously, thankfully, they trust my opinion. But you've got to build that, I suppose, reputation with the client, and you've got to get that level of trust up, because obviously, you know, it's not always going to work. But again, you can only do it with people that you know are genuinely good. But yeah, it's difficult. It's a difficult, you know, kind of process, really, to get the right interview process. But, you know, I think, like you said, need to respect the fact that you know, they're not the commodity anymore. You know, it's a dual relationship. It's a 50-50 relationship. It's as much does that candidate want to work there as do, you know, long gone are the days where you put an advert out and you get 10 .NET developers queuing up outside your door for an interview. So, you know, you just need to evolve with what the market's doing, I suppose.
I think I wrote an article on LinkedIn or something about paid interviews. Pay the candidate, come in, do a day's work with you guys, put on them some code that's not sensitive and get them to sit down and try and work out what's going on. And that's a better test than anything. And pay the guy, you know, because I recently went for a contract and I spent about a day. I did the tech test, we're happy with that. It took me about 3 or 4 hours. Went in the office, sat there for another 3 hours, and then they basically says, you've not got enough experience in commercial environments. What does that mean? What on earth does that mean? You know, that it's I'm not sensitive I can't cope with air conditioning or something like that. I'm allergic to tea in offices. Well, what does that mean? You know, I don't know.
Yeah, I know. I know. Sometimes people just they come out with, you kind of just hope, wish people would be really honest with you, because sometimes people just come out with random, kind of feedback where you're like, that's not the reason the person hasn't got the job, but you gotta roll with it sometimes. But yeah, I suppose the only downside for a client to pay somebody, obviously, it's quite a costly process to pay every person that comes in for an interview. So you've got to make sure that, they're good enough. But again, one of the things that we talk to clients about is doing what's called a working interview, where you bring them in for a day, and obviously if they're in for the full day and they like that candidate, if they don't like the candidate after the full day's worth of work, then they don't pay the candidate for their time. But if they do like them and they want to bring them on board, then obviously then they pay them for that and bring it into the as part of the contract. So it's a bit of a risk-free strategy from the client, and it's up to the candidates going there and kind of prove their salt, I suppose. Which again is a kind of a process that seems to work pretty well.
I would say do the opposite. If you don't like the client, pay them. And if you do like them, don't pay them, but give them the job. That's what I would do.
They're going to kiss a lot of frogs that way and spend a lot of money, aren't they, before they find someone that they like. Whereas if you kind of put the onus on the candidate, say, look, if you're good enough and you back yourself to get the job, then go in there and prove it to people. And generally speaking, once you've spent a day with somebody, if they are right for the job, companies will probably want to take them on board because obviously they've invested a day of time and effort into them. But no, it isn't easy, and obviously it's a continually evolving process to, allow companies to secure the best people,
I mean, I understand the market right now because there's a whole bunch of contractors and client companies that I've worked with in the past that are laid off right now because of this IR35 stuff. And there's so many people interviewing right now. So I can understand that there are people are trying to optimize the process. I still think you could get like a senior developer, call someone over the phone, then screen them that way, and then get them in for like a, paid test day, whatever it is.
Yeah, I think telephone interviews are always quite a sensible kind of starter for 10, aren't they? Because you only have to invest 20 minutes, half an hour to probably get an idea of whether the person's loosely got the right experience that you're looking for. So yeah, I would agree. It's that's probably that is actually where I say most of the engineers I work with, they usually like to start a process is doing an initial telephone chat. Is there sufficient synergy both ends? If they go, yeah, cool, actually that's something I'm interested in, and then they look to move it to a face-to-face from there. So yeah, I agree.
I get a lot of phone calls from like some companies, and they're always asking how many years experience you have with React and TypeScript and all these questions. It's just so boring, man, really, like.
Yeah, I know it's just irrelevant as well. Like asking somebody how many years, it's like saying, how many times have you taken your driving test? All right, well, if you're taking your driving test 15 times, you must be a better driver than someone that took it once. It's like, it's totally academic. It's totally irrelevant. The highest paid cohort, I'm pretty confident of this in the software engineering world, the highest paid cohort at the moment is people that are probably about 2, 3 years out of university that have just amassed some experience in, particularly JavaScript framework like React or something. And they're going into contracts being paid like $750 a day. How long they've been doing the job doesn't make a difference. It's the fact that it's supply and demand. Can they do the job you need them to? There's a certain amount of candidates out there, and you've got to pay them accordingly to secure them for their skills. So, but that just sounds like it's down to the inexperience or naivety of the consultant of how they're qualifying a candidate, because that's certainly a question I wouldn't advise people to ask.
750 a
Put it
day
that way.
is insane. I've never seen a roll off for that. That's crazy money, man. Sheesh, that's what is that a year of 200,000 or
Yeah,
something?
it's bonkers.
Just for doing JavaScript.
Yeah, it must be. Yeah, must be.
Sheesh, man.
Yeah, so it's a brave new world, isn't it?
Yeah. All right, mate. It's been coming close to the 50 minutes here. Anything else you want to share for audience?
No, I really enjoyed it. Thanks very much for inviting me on, mate. And always great to catch up with you, as always. So
What's the
yeah, let me
best
know when
way
Dan
for
Evelyn's next. And
what's the best way for
what's
people
that?
to what's the best way for people to get in touch with you if they need a data science developer or something?
Well, obviously, go to the website is truenorthgroup.io, get hold of me there, or find me on LinkedIn, Guy Bevington, and just send me a message, and yeah, obviously I'll happily reply.
Okay, Guy, been a pleasure. Thanks for coming on the show.
No worries, buddy. Take care.
See ya. And thanks, my listener, for listening to us, and hopefully you've got a better idea of the world of recruitment, and if you're a candidate or a university, then this will help you get a better job. And if you need a job, or you've got data science needs, then Guy's your man. He'll go out and take your candidates for a coffee.
Absolutely.
Okay. See you guys. Bye-bye.